You're listening to a Wheeler Centre podcast.
This episode includes references to sexual abuse and assault. If you need support relating to these topics, you can learn more and seek advice via the resources in the episode notes.
Sex isn't a human right. Yeah, it's a privilege and it should be engaged with care and respect.
The following event was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people and their elders past and present as the custodians of the world's oldest continuous living culture. Welcome back to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Chanel Kontos has generated global conversations about rape culture, consent, and sex education. Her debut book, Consent Laid Bare, Sex, Entitlement, and the Distortion of Desire, is a battle cry from a generation no longer prepared to stay silent. At this exclusive Melbourne event hosted by Madison Griffiths at the Wheeler Centre, they discuss the vital role of consent amidst a culture influenced by porn, the patriarchy, and male entitlement.
Let's get straight into it. I think it goes without saying that there are going to be many potentially triggering topics. So perhaps content warning womanhood is appropriate here, which is a point that I think you make very, very well. I want to go back to how this started for you. So we're going to talk about this thing, this phenomenon that you refer to as the realization. So before I get into that, do you want to tell me in your own words what the realization is?
Yeah, so the realization was essentially the moment me and many of my peers realized that either we had been or one of our really close friends had experienced sexual assault. And it came at the exact same time our consent talk came. Because when we started being described these concepts and taught about them and that it was necessary, and you know that things like oral sex could count as rape or that intoxication made consent void, things that should be really basic knowledge to everyone, it was quite mind-blowing for us. And it kind of like lifted the shield, and more than anything, the realization was an extremely validating experience, I think. We kind of had this moment at lunchtime, I remember it so clearly, where we were shouting over each other how many years jail our perpetrators would get for the acts they did to us based on what this ex-policeman had just told us about sexual assault. And another thing I find really interesting about that is that all of us were under the false illusion that if we decided to report, that would there would be accountability. We had no idea that the system was skewed against us, yet none of us wanted to. We just kind of had this collective experience. No one had to retell their stories because, you know, when you're a teenage girl, you know every single thing any of your friends have ever done, obviously. So it was just really natural and validating to kind of go through that experience of realizing that something that felt wrong was wrong, but not at our fault.
And there's actually no way to read Consent Laid Bare if you haven't already had the realization. There's no way to read your book without being smacked in the face with the realization. I want to talk to that because you deliberately, you start the book with this foray of what I would say are not even necessarily escalating points of obvious sexism, but unique in that they are uniquely made trivial by the society we live in. So when you started reeling off these examples, you weren't thinking about a single woman in mind, were you? You were just thinking
womanhood, like you said.
Women,
yeah.
How did you reckon with knowing that this would open a lot of doors for a lot of women to have their own realizations, which can be a deeply painful experience?
It can be, and it's an experience that I'm familiar with seeing other people experience, because part of posting a lot of testimonies of sexual assault meant, you know, a lot of those testimonies had things in them like, I didn't realise until right now, or, you know, seeing this story made me realise I had perpetrated this thing. So I think I knew that was going to happen when I wrote the book, but also more than anything, I think it was going to be, I think we instinctively know as women that those structures are there. They're maybe just not like named or laid out to us, or maybe we haven't had conversations with people to know that it's more of a universal experience. So overwhelming feedback I've gotten about my book is how validating it is. And a lot of, you know, women have called it very healing as well.
And this, well, it is, it's brilliant. Hence why we're all here today. This realization, I want to know, is there a male equivalent?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think there definitely is. I mean, maybe there must be a moment. I'm obviously not a male, so I'm not sure, but I have spoken to men who have definitely had this kind of like come to moment of realizing the patriarchy and how that's oppressing them as a person and how that's oppressing the people around them. But I also think a lot of men have said that first page of, you know, rattling off all those experiences was just mind-blowing to them. And then what was even more mind-blowing is when they went and spoke to a female friend about it and them to be like, yeah, obviously. So I think that, I think that by kind of like opening people's eyes to that, that's like such an important first step.
Yeah, and I guess that's the architecture of the Me Too movement, which had happened before this all kicked off for you. This is such a big question, but what do you make of where we are, given that Me Too happened nearly a decade ago now?
That's nuts. I don't know. It's really scary because I live in such an echo chamber and I like to think that we've progressed, but then you see studies like the Global Institute Women's Leadership released a study the other week about one in six young men believe that feminism has done more bad for the world than good. Like, that's really scary.
That's a wild thing to write down on
it's
a
really
survey
scary.
As well.
Yeah.
Yes, it's done worse.
Yeah. And, you know, we have one in five young men seeing Andrew Tate as a good role model. And I don't know, it feels at the same time, I actually think if anything, we've kind of just gone in like two different directions rather than like moving together as a unit. It's just become, I know it's such a cliche word these days because of like US politics, but just more polarized.
No, absolutely. And you do speak to that kind of phenomenon of pushback and provocation and where that kind of lives in the history of feminism as well. I want to speak a little bit about the language that you decide to use in your book, because it strikes me as being very obviously affecting. You know, you open up the page and it says, what does a rapist look like? And just the word is there and you don't shy away from that. And you make this one claim that says, you know, we live in a world that has decriminalised rape. And if we all were to sit with that sentence, that's a deeply disturbing thing to sit with. And that was sort of your point, wasn't it? That was kind of what you were trying to do.
Yeah, it's extremely disturbing, but I think it's true.
Yeah. How did you find navigating saying the quiet part out loud in your personal conversations as you were collating about 7,000 testimonies?
I actually think the first time I kind of realised how much, or at least voiced how much we don't hold rapists to account was, this is actually also in the book, I think, was when I was at a farm with boys around the campfire and I said that it's socially acceptable to rape.
Yes.
So maybe saying decriminalise is just like a bit more extreme.
And they got offended. They were like, oh my God, Chanel, say that.
They were like, as if. And then I had the satisfaction of rattling off 10 names of boys they knew who had raped people I knew. And said, you know, none of them spent time in jail. One of them went in for 10 months or something and then came out. So it's socially acceptable. You'd say hi to them at the pub. You'd play rugby with them. There's no problems with doing this. There's literally no accountability for most people. I forgot the question. Oh, decriminalize rape, the language. Well, I think also, again, people consistently bring rape back to the legal system and this like dichotomy of guilty or not guilty and how acts of sexual violence fall into those lens. And it's like, okay, well, if you really want to believe that only people who get guilty convictions are rapists or that should be held account for it, well, then, yeah, we have decriminalized it. It's not we're not taking it as a serious crime. You're more likely to get a parking ticket.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, well, it's not being criminalised per se. So, when you think about, you know, the politics of, you bring up these responses to rape, and when I say responses, I don't mean social responses. I mean quite literally the responses of victim survivors as they are experiencing something like this, and they are fight, flight, freeze, and fawn. Your focus on fawning is important here, because fawning sort of follows women outside of the bedroom, and I'd really love you to speak on that. But before we get into that, do you want to maybe tell the audience what fawning is and how you first stumbled across fawning?
Yeah. So fawning is so we know fight and flight response, pretty, like, everyone kind of knows that. Freeze response is much more commonly understood, and is also why we've kind of had affirmative consent legislation being rolled out around the country, because we understand that freezing in a stressful or traumatic situation is a valid and reasonable trauma response, which means that, you know, you can't give consent in that moment, you can't say no, which is really problematic, because it upholds the idea that the default access to another person's body is a yes. But anyway, we're fixing that. But fawning is a much less commonly understood trauma response across kind of like all aspects of society, I would say. So, history lesson, up until the kind of like late 90s, all research done on human stress responses was done on males, pretty much, which means that they reached kind of the end of the 90s, 2000s, and were like, oh, I wonder if we've overlooked something that women maybe do.
Maybe.
Yeah. maybe. And so they started looking into it. And originally it was called tending and befriending, to refer to the fact that, if we're going like, you know, way, way, way back, that women would have to tend to their offspring while befriending a perpetrator, i.e. a man, and how they have to kind of appease in that situation to keep them and their offspring safe. But the thing with fawning is, by definition, it is being over nice in a situation in order to survive an ordeal. So it's got its roots in PTSD, and if you grew up in an abusive household or around an abusive person, you are much more likely to fawn. Mm-hmm. But anyone can fawn at any time for no reason. But it is a very gendered trauma response, because fighting and flighting are not smart stress responses. If we're speaking in like stereotypical terms of a heterosexual encounter, and the male is the threat and the woman is the victim, they are likely to be stronger than you, faster than you. They're likely to be able to overpower you. So therefore trying to fight them off or run away from them physically is basically not a good idea. So this idea of fawning was introduced to me by a woman called Billy Paris, who's a frontline worker in for sexual assault victims in, I think, Royal Prince Alfred in Sydney. And it was like groundbreaking when she showed me this research into it, because I kept reading it in the testimonies, but I didn't know what it was.
Yes.
It would
As
just
in, people would sort of describe this phenomenon, but they themselves too didn't have the name for it.
Yeah, there would be like, and there was a lot of self-doubt that came with telling it, or like a lot of self-blaming that came with it. And they've also found that victims of sexual violence who either freeze or fawn are much less likely to, much more likely to blame themselves.
Yes.
And much less likely to seek help or be believed by their community. And yeah, I think fawning is just so interesting, because I really think we've just kind of all been there. Like, someone catcalls you on the street and you go, and just keep walking home, and you get home and you're like, why the fuck didn't I say something? And it's like, well, because it wasn't safe to. What are you going to do? Turn around to someone on the street when you're walking at home at night and start yelling at them, being like, why would you do that to me? Or, you know, that's disrespectful.
Absolutely. And it feeds into all of our behaviours. It's, you know, why women send thousands of exclamation points in their emails comparatively with men. Like, no worries if not.
Yeah. I think we're consistently fawning.
Yeah, we're just out here fawning.
No, we are. We're constantly like, don't hurt us.
Oh, my God. Well, it does interest me, because I think, too, society is really confusing, which is an obvious truth. But it almost like it expects people that have experienced sexual assault to fight. But it's not that it expects that. It's comforted by this. Like, we all saw the trial between Johnny Depp and Amber Heard. That was hard to watch because she wasn't a perfect victim. And I remember being so struck at that time of, you know, if someone was pushing you to your limits, and that was a man double your age with a lot of issues and who was clearly very abusive, would you not fight back, or, you know, would you not react in a way that is so perhaps not appeasable or doesn't make you particularly likable? So it's interesting with fawning because you're expected to constantly be made aware that you are not to be abrasive, but then when you're too not abrasive, what happens then?
It gets thrown back in your face.
Yeah. In terms of testimonies, how did you deal with that theme of it being thrown back in the person's face? How did you deal with that in your own frustration while you're collating 7,000 testimonies?
Are you talking about the people who were perpetrators and read themselves in it? What do you mean?
I mean more so how, sorry, I should have been more clear, how victim survivors particularly who do retaliate, say, in their own way, be it by, when I say fighting back as well, I mean argumentatively, or I mean just defending oneself, when that happens and it's thrown in their face, did you see that in testimony quite a bit?
Yeah, well, I would say that kind of like fighting back, like reporting or telling someone about it is fighting back.
Yeah.
And that's like consistently thrown back in people's faces, really.
Mm-hmm.
I think also the other thing with fawning in a situation where, the perpetrator is perpetrating out of like maybe a misunderstanding of consent or entitlement and things like that. The thing is, if you did start like kicking and screaming and being like, no, go away, they would probably be like, oh my God, they're insane.
Yes.
And they would be like, that was a completely unjustified reaction to that situation.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I guess that if we showed any kind of form of, I mean, if we reacted like a man would react, then we wouldn't get away with it, maybe.
We wouldn't be here at the Wheeler Centre tonight.
Well, sorry, that is the other thing. It's really dangerous to fight back.
Well, yeah.
And it is.
That leads me into my next question about people that do report.
Mm.
And you do spend a significant amount of time speaking to the threat of, and I say that very deliberately, the threat of false rape allegations. Mm. There is one line in Consent Laid Bare that really stuck out for me, which is that, you know, what makes the threat of a false rape allegation so terrifying is that it is an avenue for where a woman can hurt a man.
Mm.
And I would really like you to speak on that, because I think that's true of not just false allegations, but allegations in general. Speak to that arena of disclosure and what that looks like legally.
Yeah, so the thing is, anyone can be falsely accused of anything at any time. But there is a lot of kind of fear around this idea of rape allegations specifically.
Mm.
I don't know if it's because our stereotypes that we hold about sexual assault and rape make us think that by being accused of that, you're being accused of, you know, a much more intentional, malicious, violent, sadistic crime or something. But I think a large reason is that because of the gender aspect at play here, it is an only time, or it is a time where a man feels, there's also, I'm trying to remember the exact quote, there's also a line in there about how it's essentially a white man fearing that he will be treated the same way that the law routinely treats black men.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as if they're extra vulnerable to it. Men just, well, I actually don't think they do, but I think there's an illusion that they might lose their protective measure of kind of being like above the law in this situation. And I mean, obviously false allegations of rape or any act are really devastating and, you know, can be reputation damaging. But if you're concerned with false allegations of rape, it should actually be coming much more from a racial lens than a gendered lens.
Yes.
Because the histories of false allegations of especially black men raping white women in times where, you know, interracial relationships weren't allowed, that's, you know, quite devastating and deep and very real. and black and brown men are much more likely to be prosecuted for any crime, and especially sexual assault, if the victim is a white person. So mm-hmm. we should be looking at it from like a very different angle rather than just thinking like, oh, this is a false accusation around a man. But at the same time, it tends to be something that, you know, is much more a preoccupation of white men to worry about it.
Yes, absolutely. I think when you watch, you know, when you see particularly high profile rape cases in the media, I'm thinking of Brock Turner. Mm. His father's speech, my God, that's terrible. Was it an impact statement or something? His father's statement, which made mention of his life sort of ending. And I think what you do a really brilliant job of in Consent Laid Bare is you show that these entitled opportunists, as you call them, that this particular kind of rapist, their lives aren't ending. Where are they now? Where do they end up?
Yeah, and actually it's really funny because when I very first started collecting testimonies for this campaign in 2020, the first time I like did a call for testimonies, I asked my friends to send me what had happened, blah, 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 name of the school the perpetrator and victim went to and the graduating year. But then I also had a line in there of what they did now. So this idea of, which I didn't know about defamation.
Where are they now?
Yeah, where are they now? What are they doing? Well, and when those first few testimonies came in, like, very damning, like, they're in very powerful positions already and we're only a decade out of school or something.
Why did you want to do that? Why did you want to put where are they now?
Because I really wanted to make this point of, like, no accountability and also show how commonplace people who perpetrate these crimes are. Like, their defining feature is not that they are a rapist.
No.
That is something they have done. Mm. But they are all these other things to everyone else, which is, I think, why people can't kind of, like, put those two things together and understand that.
Mm.
And yeah, I think it was also, so when I don't know why I ended up taking that out of the testimonies. I'm really glad I did because that would have caused a lot of issues, but for whatever reason I did, when I ended up posting them in 2021. But at that time, that year, there was just so many themes about, you know, there were allegations against Christian Porter. Mm. There were allegations against Alan Todd, who was the Minister of Education I was working with. There were allegations against Bruce Lerman. Like, there was all of these things of, you know, very much kind of like men in power. And I really wanted to talk to both this topic of like a lack of accountability and also the ramifications of having people who have done those things or view women in those ways, in those positions. So my master's was in gender, education and international development. And I did my thesis in sexual assault in private schools in Sydney, basically. Mm. So that's like the gender and the education component. But in order to tick off the international development one, I had to look at it from an international lens. And I like zoomed out and said, these are all the alumni of these sort of schools. Mm. And this is like where they would disproportionately end up in positions of power. And that is why we have, you know, poor funding for violence prevention or domestic family sexual violence. That's why we have terrible refugee policies, because these apathetic men are going on to run our country. So it mm-hmm. actually does really affect us all, even though they're happening in these like very small pockets of society.
Absolutely. I think it's so effective to be able to say, this is a rapist and this is a man of high political or career esteem. And they are the same men. You talk to this fear in the book that to be anti-rape culture to the extent within which you are meant accepting that one day the name of someone you love may pop up in that inbox of yours. And you had to square that and sit mm-hmm. with that and accept that. But what liberated you with that line of thinking? Were you like, well, speak on that a little bit, because that is a huge thing to have to commit to.
Yeah, it's interesting. That was actually the only part of this book that I felt was difficult to write.
Mm.
And there's a lot of heavy stuff in the book when it just kind of like came out. But that was like a really emotive thing to kind of like write down and admit, because it also made me feel as though I was like laying myself out to be even more vulnerable again in case, you know, someone does read that and think like, oh, I know someone Chanel loves and I'm going to intentionally then do this because I'll call her bluff.
Mm.
Because I basically say that it got to a point in the petition where I was getting pushback from people who were seeing people they loved in the testimonies, even though they weren't named, or, you know, people felt yeah, people felt as though it was unjust and not true and whatever. And I had this moment of like, okay, well, would I post this testimony if it was someone like super close to me? You know, I'm talking like, I love my brothers, but I'm talking like my brothers. I love my dad, yes. But I'm talking my dad. Like, I'm talking seriously close. And I was like, well, yeah, I can't ask other people to confront this fact that we live in a world where people who have done these things are all around us and, you know, we can still love them and they can still be good people in other aspects of life unless I'm willing to confront that. So, yeah, that was really difficult. But, I mean, it was definitely weird. Luckily, touch wood, to date, haven't received anything where I've, you know, identified someone really, really close to me. That means I've had to, like, end some sort of relationship or it be a kind of, like, big deal for me. But I've definitely read enough testimonies about people that I know and I either see socially or, you know, sometimes I see them on, like, the TV doing something and you just think, like, oh,
yeah,
that's gross.
And there is a real labour to that too, I mean, socially. And you speak to you made this kind of admission early on in the pages of you are going to be one of three here when you're reading this. You are going to be someone who's experienced this, someone who's perpetrated it, and someone who's a bystander. I want to talk to the narrator, Chanel, who was a bystander, because there's a lot of anecdotes you make mention of in Consent Laid Bare that are just sort of you rubbing up against misogyny across your life and kind of bringing that back to the central question. When did you start viewing yourself through such a gendered lens? Did it start with this project, or were you able to kind of look at your womanhood beforehand and have other kind of moments of realisation here?
I think I definitely looked at my womanhood before. But this was definitely like an intense look at kind of thinking of myself as a woman and how the world treats me as a woman and other men around me.
And how you've watched other women too, you know, like you speak about these party scenes and I'm there. I've seen those women on those couches and it's this, to accept that this exists is to accept that you've excused it. So, you know, holding space for that, I think you do particularly well. And how important was it for you to make mention of being a bystander?
Oh, massively, because I guess that's like the whole thing of the fact of you're kind of, especially we're talking about children here, like teachers' consent and the sexual violence work I do specifically is very much on trying to prevent teen-on-teen perpetrated sexual violence, or like youth-on-youth more generally, of course, but the education program and the ideas of, you know, being able to make serious cultural and generational change are really coming from youth. And of course children, like how much can you blame a child for being a product of their own environment when everything around them's like taught them these other things? You know, there's certain things that I didn't understand were bad and I needed someone to tell me that. I always mention her, but she's here tonight, so I'm going to mention her again. My friend Grace was like the first one to tell me that the word, she's got her head in her hands, is the first one to say that, tell me that the word slut wasn't okay to say. And I was in like year 9 or 10 or something. And
you were just calling everyone a slut.
Yeah, everyone was a slut. Yeah, like we just said that word. And I remember I posted a Instagram photo with the caption, Halloween is the one night of you can dress like a total slut and no one can say anything about it. And it started this like whole conversation between us, obviously not in the context of that actual caption, but just like more broadly how me and my friend group and how we use that word. And then we stopped using it. And it like took a bit of like, oh, what? Like, no, it doesn't matter. Like, oh, it's a quote. Like, I don't know, just back and forth until we kind of got to a place of being like, okay, well, now we know that we're not going to use that word in a derogatory way to describe someone who's had a sexual encounter, because we would never use that against a man. So I think holding space and talking about all the times that like I've messed up, I think especially young people really appreciate hearing that, to think like, oh, okay, it doesn't mean that because I've done these things in the past that I would be a hypocrite to now be on board with this movement. It's actually just like we can acknowledge that, put like a line in the sand and think like, all right, how are we going to move forward from this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something to the kind of rapist we're talking about here as well. We're not talking about the Ted Bundys, obviously, even though they are weirdly spoken about a lot.
Yeah.
But we are talking about these entitled opportunists that exist within a structure, particularly within a school structure socially. I saw a tweet recently, and I'm going to butcher this, but it made mention of when that weird feeling you get when you realise you've been sexually assaulted by someone who you weren't afraid of and who, if anything, you kind of pitied and you didn't feel scared. You just sort of fawned. I want to speak to you about that kind of... when we internalise these views about what a rapist is, what sort of shame does that bring in our ability to make sense of when our agency has been violated, that I feel like I can't feel sufficiently violated if my rapist is a head shorter than me or is, you know?
Or I think, like, a big thing, again, bring it back to young people, like, if the person who sexually assaulted them was someone that they were consensually kissing at the beginning of the night, or maybe they had a crush on, or that they previously had a crush on, or that they had engaged in this way. But, yeah, it is weird that we're so preoccupied with the Ted Bundys and we all worry about which way we walk home and the lighting on the street and car keys in the hands, like, all that stuff that we're all familiar with is actually, like, quite irrational to worry about that and to fear that, because those types of people are really rare.
Well, that's it. What do we do instead with the fear? What do we do with the embarrassment, with the shame that, girls are sort of made to sit with and wear throughout their girlhood?
Well, I think we need to get rid of the shame. I mean, it sounds so cliche, but literally just talking about it is what's, like, so about it. And I think there still is a lot of shame there. So, like, again, after that one lunchtime, like, when me and my friends had the realisation, and there was no shame that lunchtime. I remember that. There was no, like, again, it was very validating and, like, very kind of, like, feels like a kind of, like, core memory of, like, girlhood and experience and bonding in a weird way. but then I didn't speak it about it again with anyone or anything for years. Like, we just didn't. And bringing up those sorts of things, I think it feels as though you're being dramatic, which is also something that from speaking to and, like, doing Instagram polls and speaking to a lot of, like, victims of this, again, very, like, specific type of sexual assault, which, by the way, for people who haven't read the book goes into, like, a typology of types of rapists and then focus deeply on a specific one that's kind of like an everyday opportunistic rapist. I think that because we're also told, you know, not to make a fuss and to, you know, be easygoing and whatever, again, kind of going that fawning thing, I think there's almost shame in trying to stand up for yourself when you think, like, oh, other people have it worse, or, like, this isn't as bad as other stories I've heard, or, like, what I see in the media, or, like, what I think sexual assault is meant to be, therefore I won't bring it up at all.
Yes. Yeah. And your point's sort of, it's never going to be as bad as how it looks in the media, babe.
Yeah, definitely looks worse there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're dealing with a different predator and something that is the product of its, you know, of its environment in terms of that kind of patriarchal wound. Are you jaded, Chanel?
Guess.
Well, I've been given permission to go here, so I want to know, are you jaded?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I definitely, I feel as though I just overthink, like, everything now. Like, even coming here tonight, I was so excited to put on my cute outfit and, like, put on, like, you know, makeup and whatever. And then I was like, why am I doing this? And then I'm like, am I supposed to, am I, like, kind of opting into these gender roles that I need to? And I don't know. I've been, like, going to quite a few states around Australia the last week, and I've spent so much time, like, getting ready. Or I could have been doing, like, a lot of other productive work in that, like, you know, hour before every session or things like that. And I have thought, like, a man doing a book tour would not have to do this, and that just wouldn't be the case. But at the same time, I really enjoy it, so I'm like, well, where's this thing? And it's also something I really struggle with in, like, relationships, my relationships with men.
Yeah.
And I don't know, are you jaded?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we're on the same page.
We're
That's
on the
good.
Same
yeah,
page.
Okay, good.
No, I find it really fun.
God.
Yeah, I know, right?
I'm clearly jaded if I find it really fun to talk about this with other women that speak on this stuff. Because, you know, it is something that you are going to take home with you, and it is something that is going to inform how you love and who you love and how safe you feel to express that love. And when you are kind of needing to be the facilitator of these realizations for so many young women, you're not immune. You know, you're still here as a woman at the end of the day that's kind of feeling it simultaneously. Which would usually lead into the kind of question of what self-care do you practice? But absolutely, fuck that. Yeah. I want to lead more into what has your... Am I allowed to... Is that illegal to swear in the Wheeler Centre?
Oh, I think I already did it.
I think we're... Okay, we're doing it.
Yeah.
What has your activism taught you about desire? Zooming out, you know, who is allowed to possess desire outside of sex, outside of the bedroom, just in general?
I mean, I think we're all allowed to have desires. We're just not allowed to act on them every time. Like, I guess that's kind of like the fundamental part of sexual assault, right? It's entitlement to another person's body. It's feeling as though your desire is worth more than their experience, whether they want it or not, which is also a really weird... I'm kind of going off track here, but I always think this about entitled opportunists as well. It's kind of like if you... And actually, the book goes into this as well, talking about, like, what is consent and, like, where are we putting these things. But if you... if you are consenting to someone, this is something I always get in my head about when I was like single and dating. If I do consent, then how do I know what would happen if I didn't? So it's kind of like, how do I know what type of person I'm having intimacy with if I do desire this and I want that and they desire that and that's really great and that's working right now. But what if I didn't? Would it be the same result? So I think, again... Yeah, we just need to... Underpinning all of this is the theme of male entitlement.
Yeah.
And I think we do need to get rid of the idea that, like sex isn't a human right. It's, it's a privilege and it should be engaged with care and respect.
Absolutely. Consent Laid Bare goes a lot into... pornography and these sort of origin spaces of misogyny and whatnot. And I don't necessarily think we have time to go into all of that because it's big. but I do want to ask you about the future of porn. And there is this new phenomenon called... Do I even know the official? Deepfake porn.
Yeah.
Can you tell your audience about what that is?
Yeah, so essentially deepfake technology is AI technology that can manipulate a video to very realistically look like... It's basically Photoshop for videos. And, you know, they started on the internet with, like, getting Putin and Trump to have, like, a fake conversation that was, like, kind of funny. Not saying it's okay to manipulate the thing, but you know what I mean? Like, they were saying really outlandish things that was clearly... not real life. And then deepfake technology has, I think it is now a very gendered issue. Very quickly it's become one because it's being used to artificially manipulate the faces of mainly women on naked bodies to create pornographic content. This is really problematic for a lot of reasons. In the kind of like, in terms of like policing and like that side of it and child sexual abuse, again, there's a lot of people who dedicate their times to trying to remove content of child sexual abuse off the internet and, you know, ensure victims are safe and things like that. And deepfake technology adds like a whole other hurdle to that because it's improving at such a rate that it is becoming like harder and harder to distinguish between what is real and what is not. And also because there's been no demand for it. AI deepfake technology has not developed to create realistic artificial modifications of the male body. It's
interesting,
but it's very realistic for females. But the other thing is, this is changing so fast. Like, I read that 4 months ago, and like, who knows what would have happened in that time? We've seen what's happened with AI in the last year, and policies and laws like cannot keep up to date with how fast this is happening. What was really interesting is I was at a school on Friday in Brisbane speaking to 400 girls, and about 5 of the questions were about deepfakes. Mm. So obviously, like, something had happened in the year group, or, like, you know, it was becoming a more pressing threat. And image-based abuse includes not just sending on a naked image of someone, it also includes threatening to send it on.
Mm.
So I think that this is kind of also being used as a tool for a lot of people to coerce others into it. You know, if you don't do this, I'll send this to your parents, and it looks like them. It looks like a naked video of them. So yeah, deepfake technology is really concerning, and I think it needs to kind of be put as a priority of a feminist issue.
Absolutely. I think there's something interesting about the way it affords men that may or do often feel entitled to a new kind of intimacy where they don't necessarily have to close their eyes and imagine what it would be like to sleep with, you know, so-and-so that they've got a crush on. They can just impose that experience onto something that isn't sex, it's porn and it's fake. But that impulse is what I'm really curious about, because if I had a female friend that came to me and told me that she had ever done that, I would be terrified. Mortified. I would be more absolutely mortified.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm sure it is used for that.
Mm.
I mean, again, just thinking back to high school, it wouldn't be uncommon for the boys to talk about which pictures of which girls they wanked to, because, you know, there's no shame around the male self-pleasure, which borderlines sexual harassment sometimes, the way they talk about it. And imagine if they could actually just artificially recreate that image into, like, an exact pornography video that they want. Like, that is really creepy. And, yeah, you're right. It's, again, like, because we can't have laws keep up with it and the technology is moving too fast, we really need to, like, step all the way back into prevention and ingraining empathy in others and reducing that sense of entitlement to other people's bodies so people understand that they are not entitled to see a naked image of someone, even if it's not real.
Absolutely. Oh, I feel like I could do this for hours.
Yeah, it's so fun. I forgot you guys are here.
Yes. Well, I didn't. So it is question time, I believe. We are going to have 15 minutes of questions, so there are going to be some roaming mics. Please be respectful in question time, and we'll start.
Hi, Chanel. You just mentioned prevention, and I work at a mental health youth charity called The Man Cave, where we have direct voices with young men, teenage, adolescent men. And so would love to know what messages you would love us to be conveying to the young people that we have the privilege to work with.
Yeah, amazing. Well, firstly, thank you for your work. And secondly, I know that a lot of kind of like healthy masculinities trainings are a really good first step before introducing consent, and that kind of tends to be what schools do. But I really think that consent needs to be embedded in that from the start. So yeah, and I think conversations, again, about these really specific things like deepfake technology, I think porn literacy is a really important part, especially for young boys to engage in, looking at this as, like, you know, what are they using this as a form of entertainment or as a form of education? And if education, that's a really big problem. So how can we kind of equip them to at least do these, engage in these sort of, like, consumption safely?
Thank you, Chanel, for your work. Do you get a sense that for young people today, a young man will not know that he is committing rape, and a young woman will not know that what is happening is rape?
Yeah, I really do get that sense. And I don't know, some people have given me a bit of backlash for that because they say it's too forgiving for perpetrators because you know, I'm kind of excusing their actions in a way by saying, like, oh, they didn't know. But that doesn't mean that it didn't have a real impact. It just means that we've also failed the perpetrator in this situation as a society. I think I've also definitely spoken to a lot of men, again, who maybe realised from seeing testimonies or reading them that they had perpetrated assault themselves, that, yeah, they had done that and really deeply regretted it. And that would be a horrible feeling to have to sit with that sort of guilt. Like, guilt's a really all-encompassing emotion. And I guess that's kind of, like, the crux and point of my argument. Like, we have both so radically normalised rape and sexual assault that it can occur without the people involved in it even fully knowing what it is. And we've failed all parties in that situation because something I'm just going to bring up quickly here is a recent study came out this year in January, really incredible piece of research from University of Technology Queensland that basically showed that rates of adult perpetration of child sexual abuse have decreased, which speaks to our prevention efforts in the space and the fact that, you know, we're not leaving children as vulnerable, we're having conversations, we're encouraging help-seeking strategies, we've removed stigmas and taboos. And that's great, and we should continue that, and we should scale those efforts, because adult-perpetrated child sexual abuse is, I think, particularly insidious form of sexual violence. But rates of child sexual abuse across the board have stayed the same, because rates of perpetration by 15 to 19-year-old males have increased for the first time ever. And that is really creepy, because it means right now in Australia, the most likely perpetrator of sexual assault is a 15 to 19-year-old male, who is essentially, almost all of them are children. So I think we really need to have like a really empathetic lens to this and think like, what's happening? So that is the case. So many people, like, why are so many people perpetrating this out of ignorance and entitlement?
Hi, I just want to point out, there is a small amount of defence you can take by photographing yourself and putting a copyright sign on your picture and then publishing the picture on the internet, so that if somebody uses your picture as deep porn, you've got at least a basis for it saying they've published copyright material without your consent.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good protective idea for things like LinkedIn, when you kind of have like a single photo, or maybe for an older bracket. But I think a large challenge for young people these days is their whole life is documented. Mm. There's not just a photo of them online. Like, I remember when I was younger, my dad used to always get me to Google him like every 6 months, and like a single photo of him, a single photo of him would come up, like the same one every time. Whereas if you, he's going to be mad at me for saying that now. Whereas if you Google like anyone under the age of 30 here right now, or even 40, there's going to be like dozens and dozens, and Instagram, Snapchat, Facebook, TikTok. Sorry, my friends who know my dad are laughing. So it's kind of impossible to, I guess, do that sort of thing. But it, yeah, it's a good tip. Thank you.
First of all, thank you for representing women and young women for this sort of thing. Even though more voices are speaking about rape and sexual assault today, is the rape rate increasing? And if it is, why do you think that is?
I think that with all forms of education around a topic, and with all like stigma removal and taboo removal, immediate reaction to that is a temporary increase in reporting, not because more things are happening, but because there's less social repercussions about it. People understand, because it was underreported before, basically, so that it kind of like evens out to a more realistic level. But yeah, it's really hard. I think just like, in my mind, it's just a very different form of sexual violence that is occurring. And I think another aspect, which might be a bit too much to get into right now because I'm conscious we're in question time and not in the midst of it, but I kind of try to dive into this in the book as well, about how much capability we have to choose our own desires when these sort of things are being so dictated by things like pornography. So, you know, things like BDSM used to be understood as a side, you know, a kink, whereas now we don't even call that a kink, but violence, sexual strangulation, choking, slapping, spitting, whatever, in the scheme of things, become much more normal in sexual acts. And like, how much has that been kind of indoctrinated into people from using pornography as a form of education? And sorry, the point there was, I guess, also that like, that wouldn't be classified as sexual violence, but if that's not actually their true desires, then it's a form of sexual violence disguised as consent.
Hey, thank you for everything that you do, firstly. I think for me, like, obviously having read your book and coming to terms with these moments in my life and my friends' lives that we never realised they were what they were, how do you suggest that us in our everyday lives gain the confidence to be able to call it out when I feel like personally all too often someone will make a comment, it's not until 5 minutes later that I go, oh, shit, like, I should have said something, and you beat yourself up, and it becomes difficult to jump on those situations without almost coming off too defensive or too over the top. And maybe I am fawning if I'm just trying to be nice about it, but that's leave that for another time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you said, like, without coming across as, like, too over defensive or too over the top, is again this idea of, like, when we fight back, they're being like, whoa, don't. It's so hard because it's just something that, like, the confidence to say things. I mean, sometimes I can be really sassy and call things out, and then other times I just get really shy and don't. And, like, you know, if I'm in a taxi alone with someone and they say something that makes me feel uncomfortable, I'm like, I'm not going to call this out right now because the doors are locked and I'm in a moving vehicle that you're in charge of. But it sounds so, like, corny, but what can be really nice, and is what I tell school students as well, is that if you kind of, like, make a little pact with friends, and, like, even just, like, two or three, to be like, we're going to call this out. And then if they're all someone that, you know, you're around socially a lot, especially in these situations, or, you know, agree with someone to hold each other to account to these sort of things, so that you're both giving them permission to... you're giving them permission to call you up without them thinking that they're going to offend you, and you think that you'll be able to call them up if they're saying these things kind of unintentionally. Maybe that's like a parent or like a sibling or something. But I think that sort of stuff, it's also like, yeah, it would be great to call out every instance of rape culture we ever saw, but ultimately, like, your own safety has to be first. And if you don't feel safe to say it in the moment, then just, like, it's okay that your body's done that. You shouldn't be mad at yourself for not doing it.
Hi, I was wondering if you have any tips or anything that you would help for how to navigate conversations with young males who are close to you, brothers, friends, who maybe don't understand the severity of rape culture or what it's doing in society, and especially having that knowledge of that 15 to 19-year-old age bracket being the most prominent and problematic.
Good question. This is actually not just a shameless plug. I actually think this is the best resource for it. Yeah. One, encourage them to follow teacher's consent, because then they can, like, ingest this content in their own time in a non-attacking way. We're putting it out into the world. If they're curious, they can click and go through whatever. But also, the last chapter of my book is called Dear Boys and Men. Mm. And it's basically exactly like what you said. It's for people to be like, how do I have these conversations with, you know, with others, and being able to just pass that on and be like, just read these 20 pages. I'm kind of hoping it's a bit of a, like, gateway drug to the whole book, but I don't know. And that's written in a tone and manner that was like the audience, like, at the forefront of it. So hopefully that's helpful.
Congratulations, Chanel.
Thank you.
As a Greek woman, I'm very proud of you. Congratulations.
Thanks.
You do us very proud. As a feminist, okay, you mentioned that 1 in 6 men think that feminism has done, damage. What is the Institute doing around that? And also the other research that is coming out about young boys feeling very confused, following on from the previous question. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's such a good question. So again, it was 1 in 6 young men, which also showed that we kind of, I think, have a narrative in society to be like, oh, like, boomers, like, they're the conservative views or, like, whatever. But it's actually showing that the younger men are the ones who are, like, we're regressing in terms of social progression and are more likely to hold problematic attitudes towards, like, gender and sexuality and things like that. So the Institute, and specifically what they're doing, the Institute's main role is research, so they're not, and, like, advocacy as well, but I don't think there's any kind of, like, direct project coming from that I know of. But I think it also just speaks to, like, such a wider message of, again, we're failing our young men. Like, if the only role model they can name is Andrew Tate or no one, that's just not good enough. And, you know, he's such a prominent figure because he feels a need for these people. And I do, without trying to... I don't want to sound like men's rights activist-y, but... but that would be a career change. probably way more profitable, actually. But... I think we have to hold empathy for them, because in this... So there's a quote that... it's also in the Dear Boys and Men chapter, that is, equality feels like oppression to the privileged. And when you're thinking about that, and you're thinking about young men who have had their kind of, like, roles set out for them and then taken off for them, whether that be, you know, being the main income earner being like a thing, a statistic I always think about is that in Australia, if a female earns more than her male partner, she is 35% more likely to be subjected to domestic abuse by him, which is just like nuts and speaks to this idea of kind of like male ego and the value of self-worth being placed on masculine traits like income. So I think we need to like fill that need and make sure that as we're raising the next generation or, you know, speaking to young kids about this sort of stuff, that they know that, you know, healthy masculinity looks like being anything they want to be in their kind of best form. And again, just like centering respect and empathy in all of that. Mm. And then I also think we need way more men to step up as role models, because it's really hard to, it's really hard to think of them sometimes. And I have a lot of male role models in my life, but they're all ones that are like very personal to me.
Yes. Yeah.
Where it's like, where are the kind of like big figures where I could name 100 women that I look up to that are in the public space?
Mm. I think we've run out of time for any more questions, unfortunately. But Chanel will be sitting at the back left-hand table there to sign some books. Before we wrap up, Chanel, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sure I express everyone's sentiment in here that you have really done a lot for women, but particularly shining a light on the tendrils of girlhood that are so complex but don't need to be. So thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much. And thank you everyone so much for coming tonight. I really appreciate it. It's so like, it's honestly a bit heartwarming and overwhelming to see this. And I loved this chat. Thank you.
Oh, how exciting. Thank you, everyone.
You've been listening to Madison Griffiths in conversation with Chanel Contos. It was recorded on Tuesday, the 5th of March, 2024, at the Wheeler Centre as part of the Broadly Speaking series. The event was presented in partnership with the Victorian Women's Trust. The official bookseller was Readings. The Wheeler Centre podcast is produced on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. You can listen to more podcasts or explore videos, news, and our full calendar of events at wheelercentre.com.